This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In the news, some Boeing 787 Dreamliners are grounded due to structural problems. Rolls-Royce financials don't look good. A positive TSA story. Another virtual flight option. U.S. Department of Energy funding for a number of electric aircraft technologies. Pipistrel plans to set 7 electric aircraft world records, while Elon Musk says 3 to 4 years for effective electric aircraft batteries. Spirit avoids layoffs, and $200 ticket change fees are dropped. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 619 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me this episode is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hey, guys. We've been having a lot of fun. So listen, definitely listen to the outtakes tonight because the pre-show was a daisy.
It was.
Or a doozy.
A doozy.
A doozy. These guys goofed on me. But the other goofball with us tonight is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
And I'm also the ringleader of hijinks here tonight. So we're just messing with you and having a whole lot of fun dressing up with crazy glasses to surprise you and to make you laugh. So anyway, Max, thanks for putting up with us. It's been fun. I mean, during these times of COVID, we just got to have fun.
That's right. We all need a little levity.
Yep.
Something to distract ourselves, something to remember that we're human beings and we like to laugh from time to time. So thanks to you guys for that this evening.
Our pleasure.
All right. Well, we're going to jump right into some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
We'll start off with an item from John Ostrower's The Air Current. This is Boeing yanks 8 787s from service over structural issue. Now, Boeing has apparently discovered a structural problem with 8 recently manufactured 787 Dreamliners. They've all been delivered to United, Air Canada, and Singapore. And it seems that there are two distinct manufacturing issues, and they're associated with the joining of the composite aft body fuselage barrels. Now, this is work that was performed at Boeing's North Charleston, South Carolina plant, and they all must be inspected and repaired before return to service. But each of these issues is kind of a problem, but put together, they limit the fuselage's ability to meet structural integrity at the load limits. And John Ostrower, if you don't subscribe to the Air Current and you are hardcore into aviation, particularly commercial aviation, but not exclusively, check out theaircurrent.com. John goes into more depth than you'll find in certainly in the mainstream press and many times in the industry press as well. But he describes these two issues, and the first is that when you're assembling these fuselage barrels, you're going to naturally get some gaps between them, and these gaps are filled with shims. And in fact, Boeing has developed quite a process. It's called predictive shimming technology. And it employs robotically operated lasers that scan the surfaces around the joints, and they automatically generate, John writes, the required shims to fill the gaps. I think that's pretty amazing just in and of itself. So in the case of these eight aircraft, those gaps were improperly filled, right? The shims didn't fill the gaps. But there's another issue, which is that the inside diameter, the interior skin of these fuselage barrels is expected to be smooth, to have a certain smoothness. But on these particular airplanes, these 787s, the composite, the carbon fiber fuselage, had some ridges. So you combine the ridges with the improperly filled gaps between the sections, and you've got something that mates, the pieces go together, but they don't have the structural integrity that they need. So, of course, all eight aircraft have been taken out of service. This is an interesting, I don't know if you call this a technical anomaly or what, but it gets deep into the methods by which these carbon fiber aircraft are assembled.
You know, I think it's kind of funny. I think Boeing needs some years of plastic model building skills. In all fairness, let's start off with, I don't know what's worse, 2020 or poor Boeing. I mean, they just, and this is the Charleston Center that we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks of them trying to move all of the business there, et cetera. But you wonder how many other ones have escaped into the wilderness that have this problem. I mean, I jokingly said about plastic models, but when you're building plastic models, and carbon fiber is kind of like that, you end up having to fill gaps, and you happen to fill with shims and stuff. And a lot of times it's a lot of slapping a bunch of putty in there and sanding away, and to get the seam that's not supposed to be there on the real aircraft to disappear. And it sounds like there's a weakness, you know. I'm wondering if now we're going to have to use the old adage about airplanes that used about cars, and you never buy a car that was built on a Monday or a Friday. You know, this sounds like it's just one of those, they started getting lazy on it, or there was a misalignment. And I wonder if these aircraft were sequential, so they were all on the same, pretty much like one after another. And hopefully if that's the case, then they've got this block that they can fix, and they know that it's just this block.
Well, I want to throw in here as long as we're being technical, let me bring in the aeronautical engineering term for this kind of problem. It's called a screw up. And so let me just throw out a few thoughts on this. Composites are definitely, I think, harder to control than metal. In metal, you've got nice uniform kinds of thicknesses. Composites, man, you got to really be careful to make sure that you keep the correct shape, in all the different parts. So I'm not surprised they're having a little bit more difficulty with this. You know, long term, I've got to wonder if there's going to be some life limits to it as well. I know some of the composite GA aircraft, when they first came out, had limits to the number of hours, for those airframes, and they've gradually, increased those numbers as the data has come in to show that they're, still holding up. You mentioned Charleston. I would submit the humidity in Charleston is a little higher than it is out in Washington State. And Cessna found out when they moved the Cessna 400, which is a four-place composite airplane from Bend, Oregon, which they bought from the old Columbia company. They moved it to Mexico. And the humidity was much higher there, and they produced a few airplanes which had wings that delaminated. Mm. Humidity is a big, big factor when it comes to working with composites. And, of course, all of this comes into play with the structural load limits, which for a airliner are 2.5 Gs. So it's got to be able to hold – the wing has to be able to hold 2.5 times the weight of the aircraft. Interestingly, this is actually a lower load limit than on GA aircraft. So, for example, the planes I fly are in the normal category. They're 3.8 Gs. There's some airplanes like the Cessna 400 that are 4.4 Gs. And then the aerobatic aircraft are 6 Gs. But I think the rationale is that, in general, commercial airliners are flown in much more docile kinds of ways. You know, you're not pulling 45-degree banks and, you know, things like that that we routinely do in flight training. And yeah, I mean, this is a concern. You want to really jump on and address anything that affects your structural load limit, because you don't want one of these aircraft to break while it's in flight, when it's in turbulence.
No. And there are some interesting questions that are unanswered, at least in my mind at this point. One obvious one is, what's the fix going to be, and what's that going to require? Is that going to be a very difficult fix, or something that takes time but isn't difficult? Don't really know at this point.
And is the fix going to be structurally sound enough to keep the life of the aircraft? One of the things that the military discovered was our carbon fiber wings, etc., on jet fighters. You know, there's a reason why we're still flying F-5s as dogfighters, and we've got F-16s retired to the boneyard, because F-16s and F-18s were losing their airworthiness earlier than the metal wing jet fighters. So, I mean, we're talking about an aircraft that flown gently, but still it's got a lot of load to it.
A lot of cycles.
Yeah. And what does that, you start thinking about those shims and you wonder, what if one of those shims gives away at some point, you know, on any airframe, you know, because it's a weakened joint, you know, and it's definitely not easily fixed. It's not like sheet metal where you can just slap another piece of sheet metal on it. I mean, we had with the 787, was it the battery fire where they had to fix the barrel? What was it? One of the 787s, yeah. I remember they had to, now this was early in the flight program, but they had to fix the barrel, and it was a lot harder than they were expecting.
Yeah, I think it was like cut out a piece from another barrel and use that as a patch.
Yeah.
As I recall. But there are some other interesting questions as well. One is, how is this discovered? How does Boeing know? Do they have the data that indicates, you know, the shim issue and the, you know, the barrel ripple issue? I mean, was that known before they were delivered? And I'm not saying that's necessarily a problem. It could just be a manufacturing deviation that, you know, is within acceptable limits, possibly. And furthermore, possibly that it's the combination of the two that causes this to be a problem. So how this came to be known to Boeing would be curious. And then, of course, there's the what's the corrective action. What does Boeing need to do going forward to make sure that, you know, this doesn't recur? But, there's a lot of detail in the air current piece. And, you know, I'll plug John Ostrower's work here forever, basically. But and I put my money where my mouth is. This is a subscription service. Each year I write John a check because the quality of the content is just phenomenal, which is kind of what you'd expect from John and now Courtney as well.
I was going to say, now we're really connected. We've got Courtney, and if people don't know who Courtney is, if you're new to the show, Courtney was one of the founding members between him and Max Flight of this show. So.
Yeah, and Courtney's part of the Air Current now as well. All right, well, let's move on to another story from Bloomberg. This is Rolls-Royce is fast becoming a British calamity. Oh, boy. Max, what do we see here from Bloomberg?
Boy, it's not good. You know, we know that, of course, the pandemic has affected the finances of many, many, many companies, so it's no surprise to find out that Rolls-Royce, manufacturer of, you know, many jet engines for commercial aircraft, has had a big loss. Their corporate loss for the first 6 months through June was one of the biggest profit shortfalls in UK corporate history. So they had a loss of essentially £5.4 billion, which is $7.1 billion, a heck of a lot of money to lose in a six-month period. But that's not actually the worst number. You know, if you look at the worst number, you look at their balance sheet and you find that they're really in big trouble. Their assets and liabilities, when you compare them, the balance sheet liabilities exceed the assets by £8 billion. So that would be the book value of the company, which is negative £8 billion. And so you could pretty much say the company is, you know, not worth anything based on that.
They're underwater.
Yeah, exactly. They owe $8 billion more than you know they have of assets of the company. So that's pretty bad. And if you know if things were somewhat linear, you know if they lost another $7 billion in the next 6 months, well, you could just add that directly, you know, to their liabilities, and so you can see that they're in a deep hole now that's getting already deeper. And they say that this apparently I'd have to find this, but I believe they said that that. A huge you know, negative valuation is apparently one of the worst in Europe, which to me was kind of shocking. I always think of Rolls-Royce engines as being, you know, a pretty, you know, what can I say, top-of-the-line company. I mean, Max, when you think of respected companies around the world, wouldn't you expect them to, you know, be in great shape financially? Or are there reasons that you're aware of why maybe they're having more financial difficulty than we'd expect?
Rolls-Royce employs a different, slightly different accounting method than we would use here in the United States. So profits and losses are reported a little bit differently. But still, Rolls-Royce, of course, as you say, has this long history of you know, being a successful company. So you know, this is tough. Bloomberg estimates that their cash reserves, because they do have a pretty good cash position, but they estimate that the cash reserve that Rolls-Royce has is good for maybe 12 months. But another aspect of this that's maybe not so pointedly important is that take any large corporation, and if anyone knows the financial health of the corporation, it's the CFO, right? The chief financial officer, which for Rolls-Royce is Stephen Daintith. So what's Rolls-Royce CFO Stephen Daintith doing? He's leaving the company to go work for an online grocer. So, you know, what does that tell you about, you know, the financial health? Now, I can understand how an online grocer might be an attractive business to be getting, you know, to be in these days, but it just doesn't look so good when the CFO is jumping ship. But all this, of course, you know, is going to fuel merger speculation. There's been speculation about Rolls-Royce merging with Pratt & Whitney or some European company for decades, really. I mean, I can remember. And, you know, nothing has ever happened. Maybe there have been discussions along the way that could have led to a merger in the past. I don't know. But given this financial condition, Rolls may be interested in finding a suitor, although, you know, there'd have to be some other synergies, I think, for it to work, because at least these days, Rolls isn't a particularly attractive item to pick up.
Rolls-Royce merging with another international company would be an ideological blow to Great Britain, I think. There's some companies that are, what's the word? I'm not even sure the word I'm looking for, but are so representative of the country in which they come from.
Yeah.
In aviation, I can think of Rolls-Royce as one. Saab would be another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine what would happen if a foreign country came in and wanted to buy Lockheed or Boeing here in the States. It would be devastating to the pride of those organizations as well as to the national pride. So somewhere in the part of me says that the British government will come along and help Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility, though you just kind of wonder, there are limits to that, right? I mean, this we've certainly heard of corporations in this country that were, quote, too big to fail. And in good times, you might put Rolls-Royce on that list because they employ about 50,000 people. And I don't know how many of those are in the UK, but I would guess that, you know, a majority of them are in the UK. So it represents a heck of a lot of jobs, and you're right about the kind of the national pride. So, yes, I think that even if they continue to have terrible financial, you know, problems, they will reemerge in some form, whether it's a merger, a purchase by somebody else, being propped up by the UK. Yeah, the UK could theoretically take a share of the company for providing, you know, a lot of cash. So they're going to be around. Interestingly, they also have been supplying the electric engines to some of the new electric airplane manufacturers. So I interviewed George Bai a week ago on Aviation News Talk, and they are using the Rolls-Royce electric engine in their eFlyer 2, which will debut in about, well, start to ship in about 2 years. That was a Siemens project up until probably about a year ago. I'm not sure why Siemens sold it off, but, you know, just to show you that the impact goes beyond just, you know, what we think of as the normal commercial jet engines.
Yeah, you're right. Rolls-Royce has been in the press a lot about its electric engine activities, and it really seemed to indicate that that's a, you know, a strategic area for them, which says that they're looking ahead, you know, looking into the future and, you know, thinking strategically that way. So, yeah, I can't see Rolls-Royce failing. You know, it's a matter of what's it going to take to, you know, to get them through this, and who's going to be the savior, I guess. All right. Well, coming up, we have some good airline stories. And we actually have, before that, a good TSA story. This comes from People. TSA employee rescues bride's wedding dress left at airport security. She saved the wedding. This sounds like a good feel-good story.
Oh, definitely. I think the TSA has all kinds of negative press, so it's kind of fun to find a good story to talk with them about. This occurred in New Jersey. I'd have to guess this is Newark, since that's the only commercial airport I can think of out of New Jersey. Maybe they've had commuters in and out of Trenton at some point. But sure enough, it is Newark. But there was a wedding party which passed through there on their way to hop a plane and go to the wedding. And imagine being in this position. The mom of the bride accidentally left a roller bag that contained both her daughters, the bride, and her wedding gowns. It's like, can you imagine a few stressful moments within the family when that came out?
Yeah.
You did what, Mom?
Yeah.
So the bride's brother contacted the TSA's lost and found office, but he wasn't optimistic, as he was told that the average response time was about 5 days, which, of course, would be about 3 days after the divorce. So yeah. He said, as soon as I submitted the request, we lost all hope of retrieving the luggage in time for the email. Luckily, the email fell into the hands of TSA Administrative Assistant Loletta Nathan Gordon. And so we, you know, anybody who knows Loletta Nathan Gordon, give her a high five for us, please. She sprung into action, and she immediately called the brother to let him know that they were on it. And they received the email just before noon. And later in the day, she found the bag, had it shipped overnight. And so it arrived just in time for the wedding, the morning of the wedding. So TSA saved the day. So great story.
It is a good story. And I wonder what the wedding reception was like, and how the mother faced the, I'm sure there must have been.
The ire?
Yeah, right. Jokes and criticisms. And there were probably some really interesting toasts that you know, included mention of the mother's gaffe here. But
yeah, and who among us hasn't made a similar size gaffe?
Well, that's pretty big.
Yeah, no, you know, I agree. That's
But in all fairness, you know, it's going to show up. You know, this is something that sounds like it's from an 80s romantic comedy. It really does. It was sort of like, it's like perfectly scripted, you know, but let's hear it for the team. I mean, in all fairness, let's not berate the grandmother or the mother of the bride too much, but let's thank Loletta at TSA for, you know, for being able to manipulate everything to get the bag to where it needed to be.
Yeah. An American hero. I like it.
That's right.
It's a great story.
I think it was last week we talked about First Airlines, the Japanese company that was or is offering sort of virtual flights, but not computer-based virtual, but, you know, real life, but, you know, your stationary flights, and including all the usual activities that go along with a flight. But now we see something that makes it easier for even more people to get their airline travel fix these days.
Well, we've certainly had simulators in the past. There's been a lot of hoopla about Microsoft coming out with their most recent version of Flight Simulator. And there is a new simulator that's going to be coming out in the fall called Airplane Mode, which, of course, is kind of a play on that switch that you're supposed to turn off on your phone when you board the airliner, which I suspect a certain percentage of people don't actually remember, you know, to turn off. But anyway, Airplane Mode is a full a representation of what it's like to fly from New York to Reykjavik in real time. So it's a 6-hour flight, and you can actually, you know, enjoy 6 hours of simulation with this game, where you get to deal with all of the kinds of fun stuff that you have on a typical flight, including rude passengers, screaming babies, poor Wi-Fi, if at all. It doesn't mention whether or not they periodically charge you additional fees throughout the the flight. That wouldn't surprise me. That would definitely put a lot of realism into it. The game also comes with a 2.5-hour flight from New York to Halifax. Of course, if you don't have that much time to spend playing with your computer.
I kind of like the whole, we laugh, but this is pretty clever. Now, given the fact that I still would, sitting on my Barker lounger for 6 hours means I still get the legroom that I've always wanted, and not that. But one of the things the article talks about is the in-flight magazine. And the in-flight magazine comes with crossword puzzles and Sudoku puzzles. So you get to do that while you're waiting, you know. So it's been well thought out. And I'm not into Sims, but I'm kind of wanting to do this just because.
And you do get a window seat, David.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. Oh, I missed that.
Yeah. And there's a teaser on YouTube. It's very short, and we'll have that in the show notes. But if that's an accurate representation of what the sim is like, it's really detailed. It's really, really detailed. Of course, you're sitting in the back. You're sitting in coach. This is not a sim where you're, you know, piloting the plane. You're one of the passengers. But the graphics look really impressive. Yeah, maybe all sims are that good these days.
And then Max could go get his hot nuts from the microwave.
You know? Exactly.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
That makes it more realistic.
Yeah, and have everybody bring a scotch. You know, well, this is we should all someday plan a 6-hour flight together, and we'll do it all together.
Hey, now, if it's truly realistic for a flight into Reykjavik, Iceland, let me tell you about my experience flying into Reykjavik a few years ago. It was, of course, on WOW Airlines. You know, flight was fine. Arrived at somewhere around 4 in the morning. So, you know, that's never a fun time to arrive at any airport. A beautiful airport, by the way. I mean, very nice, nicely done. Pretty empty at that hour of the day, not surprisingly. We gathered our baggage. We were traveling with another couple, and that gentleman had, you know, done his due diligence and I think found the best deal available on a rental car. And we then proceeded to try and find this rental car company. And there we are in the dark, outside, going over hill, over dale, trying to find this little office, which was on airport property. But there was some construction going on, and so we're pulling roller bags over, you know, discontinuities in the road and up over the grass and down over the next curb. And it was just – of course, then when we finally arrived at the office, there was nobody there.
No, figures.
Yeah, though someone did show up probably within a half hour, but it was like, and by the way, I loved our trip to Iceland. I had the most fun. I'm a guy who kind of enjoys cool temperatures anyway, which is why I enjoy, you know, where I live here on the West Coast. It doesn't get too hot too often. But boy, Iceland in September, October was perfect. It was in the high 40s the entire, you know, 10 days we were there, and just a lovely place to visit.
Everyone that I've ever talked to who's been to Iceland just loved it. Everyone. Never heard a complaint. Let's see. But we should also mention that Airplane Mode, the sim, is coming out sometime this fall. It's not available now. And it will be available for Windows and Mac, both. All right. We have some electric airplane news. Various sorts. First one was sent in by Patrick from the U.S. Department of Energy, $33 million for carbon neutral hybrid electric aviation. And this is in Clean Technica. The Department of Energy announced this $33 million in funding for 17 electric aviation projects. Now, this is under the ARPA-E Ascend and REACH programs. And I have to say, this is a case of acronyms and initialisms run amok. So ARPA-E is the Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy. Ascend is, get this, the aviation class synergistically cooled electric motors with integrated drives. That's Ascend. And REACH, which has two E's, is range extenders for electric aviation with low carbon and high efficiency. Ugh, boy, oh boy. So it's interesting to look at some of these projects, and we won't go through all of them, but just to note a couple of them. Raytheon Technologies Research Center got a couple of awards here. That's the old UTRC Research Center, with, you know, United Technologies is now Raytheon Technologies. So this is the center that was, but that is basically adjacent to the building where I worked at Pratt. They have the CoPower. That's the compact propulsion engine optimized with waste heat recovery. And just to give you an idea what some of these are like, the CoPower project will enable a commercial narrow-body electric aircraft by developing an ultra-efficient and lightweight fuel-to-electricity power generation system that includes the use of supercritical carbon dioxide as a working fluid. This is pretty tech stuff. Another one they've got is ZAP Turbo, they being Raytheon Technologies Research Center. Zero-carbon ammonia-powered turbo-electric propulsion system. And that's supposedly a high-efficiency, lightweight turboelectric system that uses green ammonia as both a fuel and a coolant via regenerative cooling. But some of the other General Electric companies got their Fly Clean, which is a fuel cell project. University of Maryland and College Park, the hybrid soft-sea turbo generator for aircraft. That's a couple of these are this soft C, this solid oxide fuel cell. Now, we've talked about hydrogen fuel cells a lot, particularly over at the UAV Digest. I'm not so familiar with a solid oxide fuel cell.
Ah, but the man has never met a fuel cell he didn't like.
That's right. And I'm surely going to, you know, research this. Another Connecticut company, and again, these are just some of the REACH awards. Precision Combustion in North Haven, Connecticut. That's another soft sea project. As for the Ascend part of this, Raytheon Technologies Research Center again has got Ultra Compact. That's the ultralight, integrated, reliable, aviation class, co-optimized motor and power converter with advanced cooling technology. Wow, I told you that these things are just crazy. The idea is to improve the electric-to-shaft power electric drivetrain and demonstrate feasibility of a turbo-electric distributed propulsion-based electrified aircraft propulsion system. GE Global Research, in this case, in New York, has got E-Flights, the electric flightworthy, lightweight, integrated, thermally enhanced powertrain system Honeywell shares has a program as well. That's a high voltage 500 kilowatt advanced electric propulsion system in Columbus, Ohio. Hyper Research Incorporated will be designing and demonstrating a multi-megawatt high efficiency, high power density integrated electric propulsion motor drive and thermal management systems. These are to meet the performance requirements of future hybrid electric single-aisle passenger aircraft. And there are a number of other of these things as well. So I think my purpose in sort of relating some of these projects is to kind of give you an idea for the number of research projects that are going on and kind of the involvement of corporations, of academia. You know, there are a lot of organizations getting government funding, and most of these run, a couple of million dollars a piece in terms of the funding, $2-3 million, somewhere in that range. But there's just a ton of research going on in the United States anyway to support this notion of electric aircraft of the commercial type.
Yeah, it's great to have money coming from the government to fund leading edge research, because a lot of this research might not get done otherwise. And of course, comes from one branch of DARPA, the same organization that was responsible, 50 years ago for the pioneering work that led to the internet. So yeah, some of this stuff really pays off, big time. So great that they're doing this.
It is also kind of funny that after all of these years, it's been almost 6 or 7 years that I was down at Langley and we were talking about electric flight. Yeah. And Ascend and Reach were just starting. You know, the X-57 program was just starting as far as Langley, NASA Aeronautical is concerned. And to see those programs continue, and move forward to achieve what seemed like paper goals at the time, to see be more becoming hardware and flying and stuff. This is probably we talk a lot about power cells on UAV Digest, but all of this stuff is really kind of cool and very different than what we're used to.
Yeah.
And I just want to correct myself here. Actually, it's not the same organization as DARPA, but same initials, lacking the D, same kinds of things happening. In this case, it's coming from the Department of Energy. DARPA, of course, was the Department of Defense, but same concept.
Yeah,
that's why you dropped it. ARPA is the same organization for the civilians, not if you drop the D.
Right. Well, also from Clean Technica, Pipistrel is ready to set 7 electric aircraft world records. And they have their Velis Electro, which has achieved European certification. But they plan to fly this some 700 kilometers from the Swiss Alps to the North Sea, and along the way break 7 world records, those being lowest energy consumption, highest average speed, highest flight altitude for an electric aircraft, fastest climbing performance, fastest average speed, smallest number of intermediate stops over a distance of 700 kilometers, and longest electrically flown route.
Are we allowed to talk about Pipistrel without having certain individuals on the show?
You mean Launchpad? He's going to be disappointed that he wasn't here.
Sorry, Launchpad. We know that these are the rights and regulations set forth, so we're breaking them.
So they're going to, live stream this, and they were to have started this journey yesterday as we record this, August 30th, but there was a weather delay, and I don't know if they've started. But there's a website and a Facebook page, and we'll have links to those in the show notes, and you can follow along with this. They say that theoretically they should be able to do this in 6 stops, but maybe 11 stops is more realistic. This is kind of interesting. As they travel from airport to airport in this electric Pipistrel, of course, they need to have charging equipment available at each airport. So what they've got is some Teslas, of course, that are going to transport the charging equipment to each of the airports along the way. So I guess we'll have sort of a parallel race in the air and on the ground with the Pipistrel and the Teslas.
Well, actually, I think that's kind of, you know, I think that's kind of a good thing, because the argument is if you're transporting using fossil fuels, all of these chargers to the airports, it kind of nullifies the whole experiment, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It just, it wouldn't look too good in the press.
And by the way, this is a sexy, cute-looking airplane.
It is. It is very nice, yeah. Pipistrels have some nice lines.
Yep. Well, actually, when I flew, which one? I forget now. Did we fly the
motor glider.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Great. And this is very, very similar to that. Now, the certification is, I'm not sure if the Velis is certified in the ultralight category, which some of their airplanes are certified, or if it's certified as a light sport. Now, that certification is different from what we classically think of. That's mostly self-certification by the company. It's not quite the same as going through a Part 23 certification with the FAA, for example. But still, kudos to them for getting this airplane to market.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, one more electric aviation-related item, and this comes from electric.co. Tesla's Elon Musk says that batteries enabling electric aircraft are coming in 3 to 4 years. So Elon commented on this last year. He talked about the need for increased battery energy density. And at that time, he figured thought that that was maybe 5 years off. Last year, Tesla's batteries were achieving around 260 watt-hours per kilogram. And Elon said for aviation, you really needed something around 400 watt-hours per kilogram. Well, Elon has updated his prediction here a little bit with a tweet. He says in his tweet, 400 watt-hours per kilogram with high cycle life produced in volume, not just a lab, is not far, probably 3 to 4 years.
Well, you have to admit that tweet hits the important parts. You know, it's high cycle life, which is something that we really haven't seen yet. Volume, and meaning that, mass production of, not just a lab, and 400 watts is a sizable output. So, batteries are the weakness on all of these programs. It's always the battery. We struggle with this when we talk about this with the UASs too. The battery life is challenging, and that's going to be the, it's the weight versus the benefit versus, we all have phones, and that eventually they stop taking charging. So when someone comes out with a battery that can hold a charge for a couple of years or more to the point, doing charges multiple times within a week of high volume, that's kind of impressive.
Now, Tesla's battery research team had recently published a research paper talking about their anode-free lithium metal battery cells and saying that they had achieved a breakthrough that improved energy density. And in the published research paper, the battery researchers said that this new battery could even enable, quote, electrified urban aviation. So we'll certainly be watching for that. All right, a couple of positive airline stories of the week. What's the first one?
It's about furloughs or lack of furloughs or commitments to not furlough, which is great. I think we've talked quite a bit about how the act that was passed by Congress basically ensured that airlines here in the U.S. would not furlough any employees until October 1st. Unfortunately, October 1st is staring us in the face, and we know that a number of airlines have already announced that they will be furloughing a number of employees, in the thousands come that time. Southwest was the first to come out and say that they won't do any furloughs at least until the end of 2020, but they, of course, have a pretty strong balance sheet, so they can afford to do that. And also JetBlue had announced last month that they struck a deal with the pilots union that will give them more flexibility in scheduling so that they won't have to furlough any pilots until at least May of 2021. And Spirit had initially thought that they might be furloughing as many as 600 of its more than 2,500 pilots, but they too have made a deal. So apparently they thought that after they, you know, did all the things they could do, that they still had 117 furloughs that were going to be necessary. And what they've done basically is figured out how through, you know, various schedule changes and, you know, temporary, you know, reductions in payment and salaries and things like that to keep everybody on board. And this kind of reminds me a couple of the times when I was at HP for, you know, the 25 years I was there, there were a couple of times when everybody in the company took a 10% pay cut for, you know, in one case, more than a year. And that was just a way to reduce the need to lay off employees. And I think employees always felt kind of more valued by the company when they took that approach. And it sounds like the pilots within Spirit have kind of come to the same conclusion, which is, hey, let's all share the pain together a little bit rather than having some of our colleagues, you know, lose their job altogether.
It is kind of, now Spirit is one of those airlines that sort of gets a bad rap. So it's good to see some positive news come out of them. And like Max Trescott said, it's nice to see that it's all for one and not one for all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I similarly experienced that sort of thing in the past that you talked about, Max, where do some of us get to be laid off, or is a better option, you know, we all take a 10% salary cut, but everybody gets to keep their job. And I think when, you know, offered that alternative, I think in many cases, you know, employees would prefer to keep everybody employed because, you know, the pain of taking a 10% pay cut is much less than losing your job, you know, in getting a 100% pay cut. So, yeah, it's cool that, you know, Spirit's pilots have agreed that they would work fewer hours each month, or at least according to ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association, almost half of them had agreed to work fewer hours each month. That would allow the cancellation at this time anyway of the planned pilot furloughs.
They did note that just applies to pilots. There are some other work groups, so that probably includes mechanics and flight attendants and groups like that, that still face potential furloughs, though perhaps those, you know, groups may also come to similar agreements. And, you know, I think we talked about this in the context of it benefiting employees. Yeah, it does benefit the companies as well, because there are costs of laying people off. There are costs of rehiring, retraining, things like that. So, you know, for short periods of time, this is a great advantage to the company as well, because it makes it much easier for them to spin back up when their schedules ramp back up and they need more pilot hours.
Now, another positive airline story for this week. United says it will drop widely scorned ticket change fees. This comes from the Wichita Eagle.
Boy, this is the fee that people hate the most, I think, which is the change fee. $200 to me always just seemed outrageous for a change fee, especially when you figure sometimes an airline ticket itself might be $200 or even a little bit less. So, yeah, that always felt like a rather predatory kind of fee. And so United basically has said, you know what, we've heard from customers and we're going to get rid of fees. And my guess is they've been hearing from customers for years, but it's really the business climate where they need to do everything they can to attract passengers. Well, they took the lead on this, and Delta and American quickly followed and said that they too are going to waive change fees for travel throughout the end of the year. Southwest, of course, has never charged a change fee, which is, you know, one of the great things about their business model, so it doesn't affect them. So, basically, this is going to give people a lot more flexibility, and hopefully it will encourage a few more people back to traveling in the airlines. Of course, it goes without saying that, you know, one does want to, you know, take all the different, you know, safety precautions they can when flying, because there is some small chance that, you know, you might catch the virus while you're on the aircraft. So you want to do everything you can do to prevent that.
Now, Cranky Flyer has an interesting piece. And he says that with respect to United, that previously when you made a change and you had to pay that $200 change fee, that if the value of the new ticket was less than the original ticket, that you got to keep the difference, the residual, for future travel. But Cranky notes that that will no longer be allowed. So if your new flight costs less, you'll be able to change for free, but you won't receive a refund on the fare difference if it's lower. So there's that little swizzle. The others, it's kind of like you have to read the fine print, and not just for United, but American and Delta, in following suit, as it were, dropping the $200 ticket change fee. You really do have to read the fine print to find, to learn the rules that are in operation here. And I'm not sure at all that they're the same rules across those three airlines.
In all fairness, though, I think I'm okay with that over the $200 change. I feel less pain with the fact that if I have to change, and for whatever reason I have to change, I mean, I'm going to get on the flight. If I'm going to lose $50, I've already sort of allowed myself to have paid that $50. So I don't see that as really as big a negative as having to pay $200 just for the paperwork to go from one flight to another.
Well, Cranky constructs some examples here, and he also shows that in some cases, you actually might be better off not changing the ticket, but instead buying a whole new ticket and saving, the value of the original ticket to be used in future travel. It'll actually cost you less. Now, of course, if this is a one-time trip, and you're not a heavy air traveler, that wouldn't help. But if you're, if you're periodically flying on trips, then it actually might be preferable to take that approach. So, yeah, this is kind of breaking right today also. So we'll have Cranky's article in the show notes as well. But again, no matter who you're flying on, read that fine print to understand just exactly what the ground rules are here.
Yeah, I think another reason why that particular issue may not be that big a deal is often when people are making changes, they have a ticket that they bought weeks ago at low cost, and now they're making a change for a flight today or the next day, which is going to be at high cost, because in general, the later you are booking an air ticket, the more expensive it's going to be. So I'm thinking in many, 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 many cases, people aren't going to have less expensive tickets anyway. So yeah, I'm thrilled to hear that the $200 change fee is gone.
But you can explain that. They've never been able to really explain why I have to fork over $200 to get on one ticket to another. I understand there's administrative costs, et cetera, so on. But it just, even if it was maybe just $50 to do a change, you'd almost, if it was, it just seemed so, like we said earlier, egregious. It wasn't justifiable, and it's really hard to justify it to the general public. Okay, the people who fly on a regular basis are one thing, but somebody who flies once or twice a year, I mean, that it's just not something that's easily explained. And maybe there's a reason why it's not easily explained.
What's up with the geeks? Well, let's see, an update on our weekly polls here. So last week's poll, or last episode's poll question, was, are you an employee or owner of an aviation-related business? And if yes, what is that business? So results are still coming in, and we'll have a more full accounting next time. But so far, 59% say yes, they are an employee or owner of an aviation-related business. 41% no. So basically, it's 60% of our listeners are aviation professionals, I'll say, and 40% are maybe fall into the serious enthusiast category. But we'll report that. And the businesses, it's a real cross-section from airlines to Boeing to maintenance work. It's a wide cross-section. But again, we'll report that next time. So we have a new question for this week's episode. And this week's question is, what 2021 aviation event are you most looking forward to?
Anyone I can go to.
Anyone. This is kind of an optimistic question. So
I'm just looking forward to us making it to 2021.
I know, yeah.
See, I was putting it as an optimistic spin on it, Trescott. You're supposed to be the optimist. I'm the pessimist of the group, remember?
Okay.
So this being episode 619, you can answer that question by going to airplanegeeks.com/poll619. They're always poll and then the episode number. And again, we don't get any personally identifiable information in these things. There's no email addresses or anything. It's just,
just your bank account number. Yeah, that's all we need.
Don't say that. So they're anonymous. And again, the idea here is just, sort of an interesting thing to learn about the audience or whoever. Very simple, quick, take the poll, get out, get on with life sort of a thing. So that's that. David, what have you got for us this week?
I just found this today and I just thought it was really kind of cool. It's a sci-fi short film. It's only 10 minutes. It's animation, but it's called The Ocean Maker. And even though it's called The Ocean Maker, it's got some really cool dystopian airplanes. The main character's airplane, most people should recognize, though it's been changed. But it's very self-explanatory. It's really beautiful animation, and it's different. It's just, if you want to look for something a little different on YouTube, this is evidently this channel does sci-fi shorts, but this was really kind of beautiful. So enjoy.
Great. Of course, we'll have a link to that. You'll be able to see that short film right in the show notes. Let's see, Max Trescott, what's new with you?
Well, David was wondering why I was pessimistic about making it to 2021. We're surrounded with COVID. I'm surrounded with two of the largest wildfires in California history within sight here from, at least the smoke is within sight of my house. And to top it off, I'm going on my first commercial airline flight tomorrow since I've been on since February. Yeah, you know what? I am kind of looking forward to it in one way. In another way, it's not going to be quite as much fun as, typically the airlines are. I, of course, have a type rating on the Cirrus Vision Jet. And for type ratings, you need to do recurrent training every 12 months. It's in FAR 61.58. And the way most people meet that requirement is they go into the simulator for a couple of days, and then they do essentially a whole other check ride, pretty similar to what they did for the original type rating. So very different from flying a piston aircraft, where your currency is a much, much lower hurdle to get over. And I wasn't planning to do this until probably October, at which point I would have just expired a little bit. But I've got a gentleman locally who's just buying a Vision Jet, and I thought, let's get this done as soon as possible so I can help him as much as possible. And I gave Cirrus a call on Friday, and they said, on Monday morning, they said, we don't have anything available immediately. And then a couple hours later, I had a call and said, we have a cancellation for this week. Can you fly out tomorrow? So I said, heck yes. I mean, great. What else is on my schedule these days? So I had to quickly put together plans here today to to head out there. And you know, part of my planning these days was a little bit different from how I would traditionally plan to take a commercial flight to Knoxville, Tennessee. I love direct flights, and unfortunately, there never have been any direct flights to Knoxville in the years that I've been flying out there from either San Francisco or San Jose. But I knew there were direct flights to Nashville, which is about a three-hour drive. And I thought, you know what? I might minimize my exposure rather than, you know, hanging out on a layover, you know, having two flights versus one. You know, why not just fly to Nashville and drive? Well, guess what? Those direct flights are now gone. So it's no longer possible to get a direct flight from the San Francisco Bay Area to Nashville. So I'm back to the original plan, which is a two-flight hop. I did find one that was fairly short, minimizes my layover time in Dallas-Fort Worth. So anyway, I'm really kind of looking forward to it because for me, you know, hanging out at the Cirrus Vision Center for 2 days, talking to people, being in the sim, you know, talking airplanes, you know, refreshing my knowledge of the jet. To me, that's fun. When I went out for the original type rating 2 years ago, it really felt like being an adult Disneyland for about 2 weeks. So it's like, hey, I get to go back for a couple of days. So anyway, being very careful, all kinds of different things, you know, minor little trivial things I'm, you know, doing differently. But anyway, looking forward to coming out of my cocoon, and hopefully all this smoke will have diminished by the time I get back at the end of the week.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. All right. It'll be interesting to hear your observations about commercial flight these days.
And when, as I was booking it, every flight said, no change fees.
Ah, good timing, yeah.
They've rolled that out quickly.
All right. Hey, we have an event that you might be interested in. This came from Tom, who wrote to us. This is an online Zoom event from the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the Los Angeles, Las Vegas section. It's titled Inventing the Joint Strike Fighter. This is going to be Saturday, October 10th, 2020, 10 a.m. probably local time, whatever that is. So make sure you get your time zones right. But this is a presentation with Dr. Paul Bevilacqua, chief engineer of the Skunk Works at Lockheed Martin. It's described this way. It says, the presentation will describe the technical and program challenges involved in developing the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter and show how an innovative idea became an international program with engineers from a half dozen countries developing a single replacement aircraft for multiple aircraft types. So again, that's Inventing the Joint Strike Fighter. We'll have a link in the show notes. That's Saturday, October 10th. And that might be pretty interesting, actually.
I just looked it up. It's Pacific time. I had to really hunt and find it because not every instance where they mentioned the time did they happen to mention Pacific time. Yeah, and I remember talking with a local gentleman here who was the program manager on the F-117, and he was actually doing some consulting around the F-35. And of course, the whole idea was to try and combine multiple variants into a single fighter. His contention is that it added, I can't remember, something like 20,000 pounds or more, maybe 30,000 pounds to the design to be able to, you know, have it strong enough to land on a carrier and to have all the other kinds of, you know, things that you needed to do. And he felt that, you know, the standard, I forget what it was, something like $1,000 a pound is kind of a rough rule of thumb for these aircraft. And he said that the potential savings by having a single model and therefore, you know, cost efficiencies in having a higher volume were totally wiped out by the higher individual cost of having such a heavier aircraft that would meet multi roles.
Yeah, there's so much politics that go into, you know, a new frontline aircraft like this that, you know, it's not always logical, I guess.
No, not going to go there. Not going to go.
Right. It's like David bait.
I'm not taking the bait tonight. I'm okay. Just going to stay out of it. We're having a really good show and I don't want to get cranky.
All right. Well, hey, something that you wouldn't get cranky about is this Arsenal of Democracy flyover. And David, as far as I can tell, it's still on. September 25th, 2020. This, of course, is the Washington, D.C. flyover. They're expecting some 70 World War II aircraft. to fly in different formations over the Washington Mall. There's some, you know, some thematic stuff. The formations will represent World War II's major battles, concluding with a missing man formation. A lot of interesting aircraft. You can learn more at the website, which is www2flyover.org. So it's not www, it's www2flyover.org. But again, we'll have that link in the show notes. So I don't know if they're going to live stream that. I imagine
they did. They did 5 years ago when we did it. You know, and the only reason why I know they live streamed it was it occurred immediately after my surgery 5 years ago, and I remember watching it from home. But you know, it's getting kind of commonplace to be able to do flyovers over Washington D.C. No comment. But this should be really good. The way they usually present it is you'll present like Europe and they'll have P-51s and B-25s, and then they'll present the Pacific or the Navy, you know, with so 20 different vintage aircraft, more 20 different types. So trainers, B-29s, you know, it'll be really cool. Pray for good weather that Friday and hopefully, you know, and pray for the good weather on Thursday for all the people who don't know what's coming but get to see the practice. So
yeah, should be very, very cool. All right. Let's see. One last item. Next week is Labor Day, and we usually have a bits and pieces episode for Labor Day, but this year we're going to take a week off, so you all have one more week to get caught up, because I know a lot of you are behind. So you'll have an opportunity to get caught up at least a little bit. All right. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This, of course, has been episode 619. So you can go straight to the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/619. This week's poll question at airplanegeeks.com/poll619. We'll be bringing you the results of that question in a couple of weeks. You can send us email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
Well, if you really want an adventure, come fly into Brandywine Airport and taxi up and see the museum, the American Helicopter Museum. I'm happy to say that we are getting more and more people every weekend, and people seem to be enjoying themselves. So it's been a positive experience, and yes, it's really nice to be at an airport again. Or you can find me on social media, Twitter, Facebook. You can find me on our Slack listener team, and you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and Max and I will send you an invite. And last but not least, you can find me talking about unmanned aerial systems on the UAVDigest.com with that guy who loves fuel cells, Max Flight, on Friday morning.
All right. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, if you're going to be in Knoxville over the second half of this week, you could find me there at the Cirrus Vision Center, though I probably won't do a meetup. You know, it's always been fun in the past when I went to different cities to arrange a meetup with listeners. But I think I'm going to pass on that until we get the COVID a little bit more under control. I did want to mention that this week on Aviation News Talk, we had a guest. The infamous Mr. Rob Mark joined me, and we talked about an update on the Kobe Bryant crash. There's a couple lawsuits which are going on. So we talked about those, and then we followed up with aviation news of the weird, because there were just so many weird stories.
I thought you were going to say news of the weird because Rob was there.
Well, no, here's the funny thing. He did create a aviation news of the weird sound effect, which I used on the show. At the very end. Yeah. That was good, David. And at the very end, he said, and you know, you need a sound effect which sounds something like this. And so I said, oh, thank you. And I went and did some processing on it and made a number of changes to it and used that. So that was kind of fun. So Rob is always a fun to have on the show. He's of course, senior editor of Flying Magazine. And he's just a fun, funny, knowledgeable guy. But that's episode 161. You can find it at aviationnewstalk.com/161. And if you want to contact me, just go out to Aviation News Talk, click on contact, and you can shoot me an email.
Terrific. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on LinkedIn at UAV Digest with David, as he mentioned. Also with Mary Kirby, talking about the passenger experience on PaxXPodcast.com. In fact, tomorrow, Mary and I are recording another episode, so you can look for that later this week. All right. Again, thanks for listening, everyone. Please join us again in 2 weeks as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thank you so much for listening.
Oh, you guys are crazy. We got the daisy glasses back on.
Yeah, it's just the old story. You try and crack up the other people. It's like whatever you can do to make them laugh.
It works. You guys keep this up. We may have to start doing video more. You both have the glasses on.
Well, yeah, of course. Didn't you get the memo?
No.
Where are yours, man?
I don't know. I'm the only one without flower glasses.
Yeah, what's up with that anyway? So what was your first reaction?
I thought I was seeing double.
No, the mustaches don't match.
I know, but the eyes go right to the flower glasses there. Oh, man. That's pretty funny. Pretty funny.
Yeah, we gotta get up pretty early in the morning to pull one over on you, sir.
That's true.
Which just begs the question, where are your glasses, you know?
On his face.
I guess I'm going to have to place an order.
Well, or, you know, come up with your own your own plan.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Not my fault. I'm only accomplice.
Yeah, well, you're a pretty good one.
Dave's only fault is he he picks up mail packages off his front porch.
Oh, that's classic.
Well, hey, I mean, you got a package from me.
I was going to say, you got nuts.
I got nuts.
You got lots of them right now.
Yeah.
You're surrounded by nuts, Max.
Yeah, some pretty large ones.
Oh, we didn't tell Trescott that I on our favorite flying in first class page that were the Delta directions for heating the nuts.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right? How funny. For the flight attendants to heat them?
Yeah, how to heat them up. And I set it to back so we could have his nuts hot.
Yeah, have my hot nuts. Yeah, it doesn't take more than a little burst of the old microwave to warm those little babies up.